there have been so many changes in baseball's rules, teams, and salaries that it's often argued you can't compare one era to the next. So would Babe Ruth be as great today as he was in the 30s? What about Leroy Satchel Paige, whose accomplishments are further complicated by the fact that he was prevented from playing in the major leagues until after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier? Now he gets the serious look that he has deserved all these years in a new book called Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Larry Tye to our show today. Hello.
Great to be here with you.
Leroy Page's nickname seems unusual for a ballplayer. How did Satchel become Satchel?
There are two stories about that, as just about everything about Satchel. The one that Satchel tells is that when he was a kid, one of 12 kids, he and his brothers and sisters at a very young age had to go out and earn a living. He went down to the local L&N train station and lugged bags for a dime apiece. He realized one day that if he would string a system of ropes and pulleys, he could pull three or four bags and get 40 cents instead of just a dime. And a buddy looked at him and said, "You look like a walking satchel tree." That's Satchel's version. His buddy Wilbur Hines says instead of lugging bags, he was stealing them, and that he dubbed him Satchel.
Well, so much of what we have heard about Satchel Paige over the years was of his own invention, so we can assume that he probably made that up.
We can.
What about learning how to play ball? Because if he was a poor kid, did he have much time?
He had very little time to learn how to play ball until at age 12, for stealing trinkets from a five-and-dime store, he ended up in reform school. And not just any reform school, but the Alabama Reform School for Juvenile Negro Lawbreakers. Like everything in the Jim Crow South back then, there were schools for blacks and there were schools for whites, and the former were second-rate. And that's where he learned how to pitch.
Was his apparent? Was his talent immediately apparent?
It was apparent to a coach there. The school was set up by Booker T. Washington, according to Washington's self-help theory of what blacks ought to be doing back then. And this was the perfect test case that Satchel was encouraged to figure out what he could do and to do it better than anybody. And what he could do, Coach Bird realized, was throw a baseball harder and faster than anybody.
So was he one of those pitchers, those phenoms who could throw the ball 100 miles an hour?
He was, and his catchers, in order not to have a hand that burned at the end of the game, stuck a beefsteak between their hand and a glove, and that was the only way they could cushion it.
Well, there are a lot of pitchers who can throw the ball fast, but that doesn't mean they're effective. Sandy Koufax had to learn how to control his fastball. What about Satchel Paige?
He had to learn when he got to his first Negro League team, the Chattanooga White Sox, the all-black Chattanooga White Sox. He would go out every morning several hours before the game and would start out by knocking down Coke bottles. Then his coach would have him throw a baseball through a knot in a fence that was the size of a grapefruit. Almost impossible to do. By the end of Satchel's day, he was doing it 10 out of 10 times.
Did he already have those other qualities, the unconventional style, the weird delivery, the many different pitches?
He picked those up over time to the point where he could throw underhand, sidearm, or overhand. He could throw with no windup or with a triple windmill windup.
All at the same at-bat. Must have driven batters crazy.
It was driving them precisely where he wanted to, which was to think about anything other than the pitch that was coming at him.
Although Jackie Robinson also played in the Negro Leagues, his name is linked forever to the Brooklyn Dodgers. Did Satchel come to be identified with any particular team?
He came to be identified with a particular owner named Bill Veeck. Veeck signed him on his 42nd birthday to play with the Cleveland Indians. Veeck rescued him a couple of years later to play on his new team, the St. Louis Browns, and Veeck brought him to the minor league Miami Marlins with him.
But before then, he was in the Negro Leagues. He wasn't one of these people who stayed with a team. He was kind of like a hired gun, wasn't he?
He was. He was actually a free agent 50 years before Major League Baseball had ever heard of that. He would go from contract to contract, bidding himself out to whatever owner was willing to pay the highest price, leaving when he wanted to, and they'd take him back anytime that he wanted to come back because he was filling the stands.
But what about the sense of camaraderie with teammates? Did he develop that sort of thing?
What teammates loved about him was that he was paid a lot of money and that their salary was pushed up because of that. And so while he wasn't a great teammate in terms of being loyal to the team, money mattered more to them. They were trying to squeeze out a living.
How did he compare to the other famous African-American ballplayers who were in the Negro League at the time? I mean, was he as famous as some of them, Josh Gibson?
He was more famous than just about any of them. The only one who rivaled him at all was Josh Gibson, who was called the Black Babe Ruth. But Satchel was a much greater showman. Josh was a shy guy. Satchel was going out there before every game and dazzling fans before the other team even took the field.
Was he exploited at all, or was he savvy enough to actually make what he was worth?
It was a case of mutual exploitation. The owners pitched him as hard and as much as he'd let him, and he squeezed from them as much money as they'd let him, to the point where in the 1930s, he was making $40,000 a year, twice what Ted Williams was making and four times what the average New York Yankee was making.
Did fame go to his head?
Yes. It went to his head to the extent that he thought that he was bigger than the owners and bigger than the Negro Leagues, and he was, and it went to his head in a way that was totally justified.
So he was spending all of his money the way many people who are suddenly rich do.
He was spending more than he earned, and he was buying, he bought at one point three houses in Kansas City. He bought as many fishing rods as he could fit in a closet. He bought shotguns, and he spent money on anything he could.
And had more than one wife at the same time.
At one point, he did. He had a wife he left behind in Pittsburgh. He went to play winter ball in Puerto Rico. He met a woman that he was attracted to, a second wife.
Did he ever face white major leaguers during this time?
Perpetually. He went out for a full season and barnstormed against Dizzy Dean, the great pitcher of the St. Louis, the Guesthouse Gang St. Louis Cardinals. He pitched a couple years later against the great Bob Feller. He was playing against major league white ball players perpetually in Latin America, in the California League. He was playing against them, and he became the standard that they judged the white players. A young Joe DiMaggio was in San Francisco when the Yankees were trying to see whether this guy deserved to come up to the major league club. They pulled Satchel Paige and a black barnstorming team from Southern California up to test out Joe DiMaggio. So it's the 10th inning, a tied game, 1-1, a runner on third base. DiMaggio has been up three times and done nothing against Satchel. He's up for the fourth time, hits a hard line drive off of Satchel's glove. Satchel deflects it to the second baseman, who a second too late throws it to first. DiMaggio's team wins. The Yankee scouts send a telegram immediately back to the Bronx saying, DiMaggio 1-for-4 against Satchel, ready for the majors.
So there must have been any number of major league owners who would have been thrilled to have been able to break the color line with him. Why not Satchel Paige? Why Jackie Robinson?
Bill Veeck, several years before Ricky signed Robinson, Veeck had proposed filling a team with the great black ball players starting with Satchel Paige. But when it came around to the time that Ricky was looking around for somebody to break the barrier, he looked at Satchel and the Kansas City Monarchs. Satchel was 39 years old then. He wasn't having his greatest year. And most importantly, to the teetotaling Ricky, Satchel was somebody who was going to speak his mind and not do what Ricky wanted.
Jackie Robinson was the ideal player to break in. He not only had all the tools, but he was well-educated, and he understood what he was about to face.
He did, and lots of people thought he was the ideal, just not Satchel Paige. Satchel thought that he was the one who had brought a spotlight to the Negro Leagues, to the Kansas City Monarchs that Robinson played on, and to the second-string second baseman named Jackie Robinson.
Who played first base when he broke in with the Dodgers. He wasn't good enough to play second base initially. But so Satchel Paige was famous with every American, white Americans as well, or was he mostly famous just within the African-American community?
In the 20s and 30s, it was only African-Americans who knew about Satchel Paige. Starting in the late 30s, Collier's Magazine, the Saturday Evening Post, Time Magazine, and the New York Times were writing about the Negro Leagues, and they were writing most of all about the most spectacular of the Negro League players, Satchel Paige. By the late 30s, all of America started to know him. And by the time Jackie Robinson broke in, nobody knew Jackie and everybody knew Satchel.
Well, how old was Satchel when he became the first black pitcher in the major leagues?
Well, that depends. If we want to look at his Social Security record, there's one answer. His draft record had a separate answer, and his passport file had a third.
Now, draft answer, he didn't serve in the military during World War II.
No, his draft record that ended up exempting him from the draft. All three of those government records, three different answers, and what they all had in common was they were all supplied by Satchel and they were all lies. The truth lay in the Mobile County Health Department, where it showed he was born on July 7th, 1906.
Now, why did he lie about these things? What's the difference?
Great question, and I think the answer he lied was because he understood that the great white ball players, the Babe Ruths and Mickey Mantles, had a white press out there fanning his legend. Satchel understood he had to create his own legend, his own sense of mystery. So when people wanted a young ball player, he was as young as Peter Pan. When people thought that his being old was cool, he was as old as Methuselah. Whatever you wanted, he was going to give you.
Larry Tye is a prize-winning journalist, was at the Boston Globe. He runs a Boston-based training program for medical journalists, but this book is about a great baseball player, Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. It is published by Random House. So he was not a kid when he broke into the major leagues. How well did he do?
Well, he signed his contract on his 42nd birthday, and Bill Veeck put a lot of faith in him. It was 1948, the summer of 48, the tightest pennant race in the history of baseball between the Cleveland Indians that Satchel was playing for, the Yankees, and the Red Sox. And Veeck was looking for some magic pitcher who was going to make the difference. Satchel delivered for him. He went 6-1. He had the second lowest ERA in the American League. And most extraordinary, at the end of that season, 12 sports writers named him the Associated Press Rookie of the Year. Satchel was delighted, but he turned to them and said, "I'm not sure what year they were talking about."
Well, he was very witty, and he was very quotable. There were all those lines like, "Don't look back because somebody might be gaining on you," things like that. How many of them were really his?
I'd say about 50%. The reporters were often looking for the perfect sidebar of Satchel quotes, and they took some of the things he said and some of the things they thought he might have said or would say, and Satchel liked them enough that he adopted them as his.
Now, what about the way he pitched when he made the majors? He was in his 40s. I'm sure he'd lost a couple of miles off of his fastball.
He had developed a curve, he had developed a knuckleball, and he had developed sufficient savvy about how to pitch that he could pitch brilliantly into well beyond his 40s.
And did he do all of those wild things, the windmills and stuff, in the major leagues?
He did them everywhere he could. He did his most famous and my most fun pitch for him was his hesitation pitch. And this is something he learned on the streets of Mobile. He learned that when you were throwing rocks at a rival gang, if you threw a rock at somebody, they'd duck and you'd miss them. But if you threw it, hesitated halfway through the throw, and saw them ducking, they were literally a sitting duck, and you could pick them off. So he did that in baseball, and he'd hesitate halfway through his delivery. The batter would start to swing. By the time he threw it, they were through swinging, and some umpires called it a balk. More often, he got away with it.
But isn't that a balk?
It is a balk, but he got away with it.
So... how long did he wind up? He pitched for a number of different teams, you say. Bill Veeck kind of took him from place to place?
Satchel said over his lifetime he pitched for 250 teams. And judging from the analysis I did of his claims, I think it's probably true. He pitched in the Negro Leagues for any team that would rent him out. He barnstormed. He pitched in Latin America. And then he pitched his last three brilliant innings when a guy named Charlie Finley, who owned the Kansas City A's, brought him in at age 59 years, 2 months, and 8 days.
Wow.
Set him up in the bullpen in a rocking chair with a nurse in a white uniform and his own personal water boy. And the fact was, Finley didn't care what he did. He'd probably get shellacked when he went out to the mound. Satchel had something else in mind. He went out to the mound and for three innings shut out the Boston Red Sox. The only guy to get a hit off him was Carl Yastrzemski, who after the game went up and gave him a bear hug. And that was partly because Yastrzemski adored this old guy and partly because a generation before, Yastrzemski's dad had hit against Satchel in a semi-pro game on Long Island.
So I'm sure Satchel was throwing only junk at that point. But junk can be very effective.
It was, and he threw whatever it took. His catcher that night was exactly 30 years his junior.
Now, didn't he say after he retired that he had been treated badly by the Indians?
He said he'd been treated badly because he was very upset, partly that the Indians eventually, after his second season with them, let him go. But more importantly, when he made it in 1948 to the World Series, helping take them there, he only pitched a token appearance in a game that was already lost, and he was very upset about that.
Now, a lot of players hate showboats, and basketball went through a transition after Dr. J and some others, and now showboats kind of dominate. But in baseball, there's always been a certain amount of resentment. People who even pump their fists as they run around the bases after they hit a home run. Do people resent what Satchel was about, or do they recognize the fact that that was part of his whole shtick?
They recognize that they were setting records everywhere the Indians went that year for attendance, and Satchel was drawing them in. He was so charming and so delightful to the players that they became charmed the same way the fans were being.
So he pitched those three shutout innings for the Kansas City A's. And then what happened? Was that the end of it? I mean, I would think that you'd go out after you'd been shellacked, not after you pitched shutout innings.
Yes, at age 59, he should have gone back to that rocking chair and settled in with the nurse and the water boy. In fact, he had had seven kids at an older age, and he had no choice but to go back to the barnstorming, going to any town that would pay him into his 60s. We think Clemens was old when he came back at 45. Satchel was out there pitching into his 60s.
And he didn't have steroids to help him.
We don't think he did have steroids to help him.
And so he pitched into his 60s, and then what happened?
And then what happened was he became old, and for the first time in his life, he did what he promised he would never do. He looked back and started remembering the wrongs that were done to him, and the only time in his life where he was ever bitter and ever backward-looking was in his later years.
Nobody asked him to write a memoir?
He wrote two memoirs, but he wrote them earlier on in his life. He never trusted the press to sufficiently fan his legend and get it right. So he wrote one memoir, and then 15 years, he told the stories again and quite differently in a second memoir.
And the bitterness, you'd think that there was no reason for him to be bitter. Finally, he had had a fabulous career.
He had. Unfortunately, he had ill health in old age. And when you're sitting there, often in a wheelchair with an oxygen supply, you have plenty of time to think about the people who aren't remembering how great you were.
And so there he is, a bitter man. But he must have been aware that he had changed the game.
He was totally aware he had changed the game, and I prefer to remember him not in those few years in his later life when he was looking back, but in the extraordinary period where he was not just a baseball pioneer, but a racial pioneer.
Now, another racial pioneer was Louis Armstrong, who also had a Satchel in his name. They used to call him Satchmo, Satchel Mouth. Were they ever confused?
Well, Louis only had one story on where his name came from, and Satchel loved Louis, but he was a better storyteller.
Larry Tye tells the story of Satchel, the real story. You had to separate fact from fiction, which must have been very difficult in this case, in a book called Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. It is published by Random House. Are you going to go back to thinking about medical reporting now?
I'm actually writing a biography for Random House on Superman.
Uh-huh. Well, that will join other books, The Father of Spin, Homelands, and Rising from the Rails. Also wrote the Kitty Dukakis' book with her.
Correct, an electric shock treatment.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Great to be with you.